Welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell with you now on RN. It might be back to business for you today. Perhaps you listen to us while running a homegrown business. How much of your life has this consumed? How far do you want to take it? Our Monday Modern Dilemma has one listener deeply pained about that question as her partner's venture is struggling to bring in the bacon. Also on the show, nothing about us without us. It's that great mantra of disability activists. But a group of high school students are fundamentally rethinking how they see disability, including their own. But here's a great question. Perhaps it's the question of our times. What do you think makes a good school? A few generations ago, your answer might have been, well, a good school is one that is close to home, your local public school. Or is it more about whether it connects with your religious values? What about a principal, a school principal with real vision or inclusive, motivated teachers? Whatever the case, it seems there are now endless variables and competing messages for parents to weigh up. What Makes a Good School is the name of a new book written by public school advocate Jane Carrow, well known to Life Matters listeners, and school principal Chris Bonner. It's their second book together, and I welcome Jane Carrow to the program.
Hi, Natasha.
Gee, we've had some terrific comments on our Facebook page on this one. Look, I mean, today's parents seem to spend a lot of time, a lot of energy thinking about what is the right school for their child. Why has school choice become so angst-ridden?
Choice drives anxiety. There's a lot of evidence now amongst choice theorists that people don't like no choice. That makes people very unhappy. But when they get unending amounts of choice, that makes them equally unhappy because it's very hard. Nothing's perfect. When you choose one school, you have to not choose the others. And lots of schools have different things that they offer and different strengths. And so choice makes people anxious. By giving parents unending choice of schools, so constantly creating new layers of schooling, which governments seem to be doing all over the Western world, it is inevitable that we will make parents feel more anxious.
Are parents searching for perfection? Is this an impossible dream?
Well, perfection is an impossible dream, so anyone who is, just drop that one right now.
Exactly.
Also, it would be damaging. A perfect school would be a very, very bad preparation for life for any child. One of the good things about schools is that kids have to get out there and mix with people who don't think they're special, who don't think they're amazing, who just think they're another kid. I'm not talking about the teachers here, I'm talking about the other kids. This is a really important life lesson for kids to learn. Mm. So you actually don't want a school which is too protective. That's not necessarily doing your kids any favours either.
Jane, do you think people are falling back on an assumption, and particularly in the context of the public conversation about school funding, that the more you pay, the better the school?
Yes. I think we've been trained as consumers to believe that what you pay more money for is of higher value than that you can get for free. We also, I mean, my marketing and advertising background means that I know that we value what is hard to get. So we value scarcity. We value what we have to work hard for. So the public school that's open to all comers down the road, by definition, we see as less aspirational, if you like, than a school where you have to go on a waiting list and you have to pay to go on the waiting list, or you have to be interviewed, or, you know, there are hurdles that you have to climb over before you can get your kid in.
Mm. I mean, a good school might mean very different things to different stakeholders, let's call them as you do in the book, students, parents, and the third stakeholder for you describe as the nation, which is an unwieldy beast at the best of times. But how different are the visions for a good school between those three different stakeholders? I mean, kids might think have very different viewpoints about what a good school will be for them compared to a parent.
Oh, very much so, and particularly, of course, as kids get older, because that's the other thing. We sort of talk about kids as this amorphous lump, but a five-year-old is very, very different from an 18-year-old, and what they want from a school and what they will often actively lobby for may be entirely different. So the conflict, if you like, between parents and students in terms of what they want from a school increases as students get older. I think with primary schools, parents – you know, they're relatively hopeful about school at that point because five-year-olds are absolutely lovely. And so no one's frightened. They sort of, primary schools are gorgeous places full of, you know, lovely paintings on the walls. It doesn't really matter whether it's public, private or what it is. They're, you know, they're lovely. And there's much less anxiety around that. Mm. One of the reasons that anxiety grows as kids go through school is actually our anxiety about our teenagers is growing. Mm. We are more anxious about them. There's probably more conflict. And that's not a bad thing. That's a healthy thing. That's a teenager growing up to start to assert themselves as a separate person. And that conflict can be exacerbated by, you know, mum and dad wanting the kid to go to one school, the kid, you know, digging their toes in and wanting to go to another. So that's where some conflict can arise. And the nation, of course, has, again, conflicting needs from schools. After all, it's easy to create a highly educated elite. Any tin pot dictatorship anywhere in the world creates a highly educated elite. There's nothing special or hard about that. What's really hard, what's really demanding, what really marks out a nation as civilized is a nation that can create a well-educated general population. And that can sometimes be in conflict with parents' quite understandable desire to advance their own children, you know, ahead, perhaps, of others. The nation's interest is to make sure everyone gets a good education.
Well, let's come back to the actual school campus and the people in it. And before we do that, though, I want to take some calls because, of course, we're getting good calls on this one. Maria from New South Wales, you're a teacher.
Yes, yes, I am. I teach at a public school.
So what makes a good school for you?
Oh, the parents.
Uh-huh.
So the parents who value the school, value education, and they're prepared to back the teachers up and work with the teachers.
So what does that make it, why does that make a difference?
It's because the kids are getting the right messages, the kids are being pushed at home, the kids are really keen.
Makes your job a whole lot happier, I imagine, because everyone's on the same
definitely page
and kids are in the middle. Thank you, Maria, very much. Kathy in Victoria.
I'd say the teachers.
Mm-hmm. And have you had an experience of a good teacher?
Well, my daughter's just started in prep and she adores her teacher. So consequently, she loves school.
Thanks, Kathy.
No worries.
Jane, teachers are key and there are some really nuanced comments about teachers and how that flows into a creative curriculum that's surprising and innovative and fun coming in on our Facebook page. This is key, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, but I think both the callers are absolutely right. Parents are really important. Teachers are really important. One of the things we say in the book is if you really want to know how your kid's going to turn out at the end of their school career, look in the mirror.
Mm.
In the end, parents have the most influence on how their children do at school. Every child in their school career, no matter what school they go to, will get some inspirational teachers, lots and lots of very good, highly adequate, competent teachers. They'll always get one or two that the parents may describe as bad, may indeed be not particularly good at their job, or may not just get on with that child. Teachers are human beings. That's all we've got. We've only got human beings to choose from as far as teachers are concerned, and they won't be perfect either. And, of course, teachers have lives, and sometimes they may be going really, really well, and then something terrible happens in their personal life, and that may affect their teaching as it would affect all of us in our job. And a lot of the finger-pointing and blaming that's going on at the moment about teachers, particularly, I think, by governments, is actually having the opposite of the intended effect. I sometimes think if governments of all flavours in Australia had set out 30 years ago to lower the morale of teachers in Australia, they couldn't have done a better job. And if they wanted to do something that would really damage the educational opportunities of children, that would have been the thing to do, lower the morale of the teaching profession.
And your co-author, Chris Bonner, made an interesting point in the book. Good schools connect teachers to each other. So it's very much about fostering a community as well amongst the teachers, but also amongst the parents and amongst the wider community. Let's come to some more calls. Stephen in Sydney.
Yep.
You've been touring schools.
Well, a while back now, I did 255 schools over 35 weeks. And while I agree that teachers and parents are incredibly important, we found that the way the children talked to us when we drove into the gate and got out of the van could tell us exactly what the principal, headmaster, or headmistress of the school was going to be like.
How?
Just the way that they talked to us, whether they were open and friendly and welcoming and respectful. Or it was really uncanny, and it became so weird that we would be all ready for it when we drove into a school, and we were always right.
Stephen, thanks for that. That's okay. A very strong point, and I'll come back to you, Jane, right. On that one in a tick. Kath in Victoria, hello there.
Oh, hello. How are you going?
Yes, what makes a good school for you?
Look, we're part of a little tiny bilingual community in the inner city of Melbourne, and I think diversity and flexibility is really important. We have people coming and going a lot, and it means that the children are always able to accept otherness with inquiry and wonder rather than suspicion. I've been really moved at how beautiful the community is at welcoming and then sort of celebrating people's comings and goings and with the different languages and cultures they bring with them.
That's a beautiful point, actually. Thanks, Kath.
No worries.
And Frank in New South Wales. Hello, Frank. You're pointing to facilities as being crucial.
Well, yeah, because as the Gonski report so vividly pointed out, that the provision of proper facilities and support within every school is should be an absolute right. And you're talking about people having, as if people have choices in regard to education. The vast majority of people have no choice as to what school they go to. They have to go to because of economic and locality circumstances, have to go to the local public school. And the Gonski report pointed out so clearly that these schools are clearly deprived of the necessary facilities to make them into a good school. If you provide those facilities, then the teachers and the parents that everybody else is talking about have something to rally around, not something they have to accept or be told or convinced that it's a second choice, that if you had the money, you'd go somewhere else. I mean, in Finland, where education is the highest in the world, they don't have private schools, and it's absolutely important. And Jane, I know she's a great advocate, but if you read the Sydney Morning Herald obituary today, you will see a record of somebody who spent a whole life trying to change the system so that the public system, and women in particular, have access to education right throughout the world.
Frank, thank you very much for that. Yes, the Finns find our obsession with parental choice intriguing indeed. Neil in Melbourne, you think teachers, not facilities.
Yes, without a doubt. And just, it's interesting to pick up on what Frank was just saying. I agree, facilities to a certain level, but once you reach a minimum threshold, facilities don't make the difference. The school my children attend is a private school in Melbourne, and I'm eternally frustrated with their need to continue to build gymnasiums and swimming pools and art centres and the like. And as I said to the headmaster, I would rather have you have the highest paid teachers in Australia and the kids being a demountable, because I've seen the difference between great teachers and average teachers in the way my kids engage and then the way they perform.
That's a very powerful and clear point you make. Jane, briefly on principals, there's a federal and state government push to give principals more autonomy. So the role of principals may potentially become more and more critical with that push towards autonomy. How important did you find principals are in terms of defining a good school?
Our principals are important, but a leader in a school. So sometimes it's not the principal. Maybe it's the deputy principal. Mm. Maybe it's the head of the infants school. You know what I mean? There has to be somebody that parents can focus around that creates that morale and that camaraderie amongst the staff. Often, most often, it's the principal. But if it's not, often someone will step into the breach. The problem is, at the moment, we know in parts of New South Wales anyway, and not just in the public system but also in the Catholic system, that applications for principals' jobs are falling because we're making the job almost impossible for someone to do. These people are exhausted. They are being asked to perform as superhumans. And everyone's looking at them and pointing fingers at them. Now, autonomy's great if we mean real autonomy. And that means choice over curriculum, choice over what you teach your kids because of the kind of population you have in your school and the things that will suit them. When we talk, because we know that the only thing that makes the difference in terms of outcomes is not autonomy over
even hiring and firing or all that kind of and finances and things like that. There's no evidence that that makes any difference to outcomes for students. Where we know that principal autonomy does make a difference is in terms of being able to design the kind of teaching and learning that goes on in this school. What kind of autonomy are we talking about in Australia? The exact reverse. We're talking about the kind of autonomy that gives principals who went into the job because they love teaching much more administrative work. Well, there's a really good way to chase people out of a profession, particularly the best who have options. That is to give them more of the work they don't like and less of the work they do like.
And parents,
so we need to think about this. We can't just go off on slogans, you know.
No. I mean, and parents do need still have to make an assessment about what's a good principal and what and who's not. Let's take a few more calls. Paul in Victoria.
Look, I'm involved. I'll put the cards on the table. I'm involved in a Montessori school, and I'd back up that leadership is crucial, but I actually think that the method of teaching and the curriculum, as Jane says, is critical.
Yes, indeed. Jane, this is key, isn't it? I mean, curriculum and how it's delivered. You know, we've become very formulaic in the conversation about a national curriculum and curriculum standards, and we forget that learning is about fun. You quote from Socrates in your book. It's a delicious quote. Education is the kindling of a flame, not the filling of a vessel. Isn't this what it's all about?
Absolutely, and we've got to come up with ways of engaging our students. Now, and particularly in schools that are doing it toughest, doing the heavy lifting, curriculum's fine if it gives people broad parameters. These are the kinds of things we want your kids to know at the end of whatever year it is. But when they start prescribing how it should be taught, what the subject matter has to be, et cetera, that's when it starts to suit the sorts of kids, you know, the mainstream maybe, but not the kids on the outside. And that's when it gets really frustrating for teachers. Also, the creativity of teaching is to look at the class you've got in front of you and say, okay, how do I really turn these kids on? How do I really get them engaged? So that you need to give teachers, you need to give principals, you need to give schools the opportunity to perform at their absolute best professional level.
Mm.
Just quickly to get back to the facilities argument, because it's particularly important at the moment. Facilities, of course, to a minimum standard are, and to a reasonable standard, are very important in and of themselves, because they also release teachers from having to move furniture or having to, you know, do the basic kind of things, hours of photocopying and stuff, rather than actually what their job is and what their skill set is. But more importantly than that, the kind of facilities we give to a school or we are prepared to fund for a school sends a very important message to everybody in that school about how much we value their education comparatively. And that's the problem. We now have a lot of teachers and kids in schools who feel very much that they are clearly being sent a message by society which says, you're second class, we don't care about you as much as we care about those kids on the hill, and you can see it by the crumbling facilities around you. So it's not only that they're not glamorous, it's that they send a message. Kids in public schools now in Australia, shockingly, refer to themselves as going to the POV or POVO school. That's short for poverty.
The interesting thing about your book is that, in fact, it doesn't weigh into the public-private distinction. It really grounds people and readers in terms of what actually they should be looking for and what questions they should be asking for of a school. Let's take one final call in the last minute. Chris in Melbourne.
Hello. Yes, I'd just like to say that I've got some children at school, and for me the most important part is, like we've said, that sense of wonder. I want them not only to be taught something, but I want them to have this sense of wonder. Is how is that possible? How is that wonderful? How is that relevant to me in my life? And how can I use that? All those senses that they're allowed to inquire about things and have that amazement. They come home and say, guess what we learned today? And it's not just the information, but it's how it's useful.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. And what a wonderful way to bookend this conversation. Jane Caro, thank you very much for joining us. We could have gone for 2 hours. I wish we could.
We could indeed.
But thank you, Jane, very much for joining us. Jane Caro. And Jane Caro, with co-author Chris Bonner, has written What Makes a Good School. It's published by New South Books. You're with Life Matters here on RN. Natasha Mitchell joining you. And if you got teased at school for being different, hallelujah, all the interesting people are, then the next story will give you hope for high school students. If you can see you through my eyes instead of your ego, I believe you'd be surprised to see that you've been blind. before you accuse, criticise and abuse, walk a mile in my shoes. Joe South sung those lyrics way back. I thought they were mighty pertinent to our next story. If you have an obvious disability, you've probably got used to people's awkwardness around you as they angst about what to say and how to act, where to look. God, we make it hard for ourselves, don't we? A Victorian initiative wants to help confront this awkwardness early on, especially at high school, where any hint of difference, you'll recall, can see you harassed and teased mercilessly and with long-standing consequences often. The Young Ambassadors Program targets students in years 9 to 12. It's run by Scope, a non-profit disability provider in Victoria. It combines study units with very practical opportunities for students with and without disabilities to work alongside each other. And I'm joined today by Jaben Saunders, an educator with the Scope program, Kirsty Lamb, a student who's been part of the program for the last 2 years, and Long Tran, another student who completed the program last year. Welcome, all of you, to Life Matters.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Excellent to have you. Jaben, I will start with you. As part of this program, you talk to other students about your own life story. What's your disability? Because it's very rare and it's actually got a very interesting name.
Yes, it is quite rare. Its name is mitochondrial epileptic red ragged. Fibers. It's a neurological condition. What it means is it affects my coordination and my hands are constantly tremoring. My balance is affected substantially and I can't coordinate my balance when I'm walking and standing, and quite often people who don't know me think I'm drunk. And it's quite frustrating when strangers look at me and, you know, that their narrow-minded opinion of me.
And I guess few people have heard of mitochondrial epilepsy with ragged red fibres. It's a very rare condition, a very rare form of epilepsy. When you present to students, what do you want people to hear from your presentation? What are you tackling with them?
Firstly, that even though I look drunk and my speech is very slow and slurred, that it is okay to communicate with me and other people who have communication problems. And also, I am very keen on bringing out the awareness of Tisha, who is my assistant dog.
Oh, this is your assistant dog, so Tisha comes along with you.
Yes, she does, and most of the questions from the students are about Tisha and...
Which doesn't surprise me because everyone's a sucker for an animal, but it's much more than, I guess, encouraging people to know that communication is possible and it just takes time and patience. But you go much further than that and give people a real sense of the fullness of your life. So I gather there are photos of you rock climbing and there's a video of you skydiving. I mean, so that you're communicating much more about yourself in these presentations, aren't you?
Yes.
We also should say, because this is radio, and we're actually in different studios, such as the illusion of radio, but you also present to them as a man with long hair and tats. So in working with a young audience, they're going to have an instant connection with you.
Yes, and that's what I really admire about my job, and that I am going to do a presentation before the students. They're already aware that I have a disability, and all of a sudden here's this guy with long hair, tattoos, into loud music, and who has a great dog. So I think it's easy for them to build a connection with me, and all the ice that they mentally build, and you know, all the awkwardness and they mentally built up melts away, and they think this guy is really cool. So I think as my personality gives them that confidence and allows them that freedom.
Long Tran, let me come to you. You're one of the students who participated in this program, so you're in effect one of the audience members for presentations like Jaben's. As it turns out, you understand both experiences because you yourself have grown up with a language disorder, I gather, a type of dyslexia.
Yeah, it is a form of dyslexia. Mainly it's processing information. So growing up, you know, when I was given the information to respond, it takes me a while to respond back.
How has your own experience of a language disorder, I guess, allowed you to empathise with some of the people giving presentations about disability in this program?
Because I understand what's like, you know, with communication barriers and some of the clients, like, you know, that gives out the presentation, they stutter sometimes, and I can relate to that.
Mm. And there are frustrations, you know, aren't there?
Exactly. When you're trying to say something and you can't find the words to say it, it takes a while and it frustrates you a lot to communicate to your audience or to whoever you're going to speak to, especially with friends or family or anyone else you're talking to.
You worked alongside one man with disability, Cam.
Yeah, I have, yes.
And
he's a really cool guy.
Tell us about that and what that process and that relationship was like for you.
Well, with Cam and me, it just started off, you know, I was doing the Young Ambassadors program, doing balloon football. That's when I first met Cam. At first, it was hard for me to understand him because he talked to me through a machine. And so that's a communication barrier between me and Cam. But then slowly, you know, during months and that passed by, I slowly learned to communicate with Cam by being patient and, you know, waiting for him to respond back. Because, you know, when I ask him a question or, you know, have a conversation with him, it takes Cam a while for him to type in on his keyboards to, you know, to respond back to me. So I'm patient. I wait for, like, you know, roughly around 5 or 3 minutes for him to respond back.
What's this process of developing this communication with someone like Cam done for you?
Well, first of all, I follow the Scope model ever since I started working. Working with Scope and doing their program. You know, you see the person, not the disability, and so that's something I never realised that I followed before. Because before I met Cam or anyone else or done anything with Scope, I never, you know, recognised people with disability or, you know, learned to communicate with them or, you know, understand or have empathy for them. Yeah, alone accepting my own disability. You know, when I was in year 11, I found out I had a disability. It was really hard for me to accept it. And, you know, ever since I've been, you know, doing the Young Ambassador Program, Scope, my finish, it gave me that sense of identity, you know, knowing that, you know, it's a closure feeling to know that it's okay for me to have a language disorder, and it's okay, you know, for me to tell people that I have one. And so, yeah.
Gee, that's a powerful outcome, isn't it? I mean, through engaging with someone like Cam, you come to accept yourself.
Yeah, he taught me a lot. Like, seriously, he just, you know, talking to Cam and just, you know, because he's in a wheelchair, cerebral palsy. He's happy with his life, you know. And so that's opened my eyes up to live the best of my life as well. So I learned so much from Cam and the other guys at BFL, at the Balloon Football League.
What was that one?
The Balloon Football League, BFL. That's the program I did with Scope.
So what is balloon football?
Pretty much it's a sport that people in wheelchair play. They follow the AFL rules and it's played on their basketball court as well, and it's been modified so you use a weather balloon, a big massive weather balloon.
So this is what you actually do alongside partners like Cam?
Yes, that's what I did with Cam last year, yeah.
So Kirsty Lamb, let me come to you. You're currently in the thick of all this. You're actually studying at CEDA, that's Sports Education Development Australia. How does this Young Ambassadors program fit in with what you're studying?
Yeah, so as part of our course, we have to complete the Silver and Bronze Young Ambassador Certificate. So in my first year of CEDA, we completed them. We weren't doing balloon football, we were actually doing modified cricket. So it was a modified game. The participants would, if they couldn't use their hands, we would grab their hand for them and they'd press a button and a ball would roll down sort of like a pipe, I guess you could say, and it would bounce until it got to what is known as the batter's end in cricket, where someone else would press a button and a bat would swing. And eventually it would hit the ball and they got to run and field the ball like normal cricket. So, yeah, as part of the CEDA program, you have to complete your certificates with either doing the balloon football or modified cricket.
What do you remember were some of your perceptions before you got involved in working alongside some of the people who have disabilities in this program?
Yeah, so for my family, I've got a cousin with cerebral palsy who can't walk or can't eat, can't talk. So for me, I sort of already had that awareness of how to work with people with a disability. But I know for sure that my classmates had never done anything or you know, never had the awareness. So for them, it was a massive experience just to, yeah, be aware, pretty much to see the person and not the disability was, as Long said, it makes a massive difference in everyone's eyes when they see somebody with a disability.
It's a great line, that, isn't it? See the person, not the disability.
Yeah,
but in those sort of first sessions where people present to you, is there a, can you feel the awkwardness?
Yeah, absolutely. People aren't too sure what they can say to them, if it's okay to ask them a question about their life and whatever else. So, yeah, there's definitely some awkwardness, but once you spend a little bit of time with them, with the programs we do are around about 10-week programs, you really do get to know the person, which is awesome.
Where do you think that awkwardness comes from? What is it about us humans that means we can't see the person through the disability?
I guess it's just the fact that our lives are different. So, you know, we can do everything we want to, whereas someone with a disability can struggle to do two things. They obviously want to be like us, and but I guess it's just that point where they struggle. They wish they could, but I guess it's just a matter of, on our behalf, is to be aware of that, you know, not to take life sort of for granted.
Yes. Yeah. Even though you do have a cousin who lives with cerebral palsy, has participating in this program changed some of your perspectives?
Yeah, absolutely.
Has it confronted some of your perspectives?
I think it's changed. There's no doubt about that. You get to know people a lot better and have a better understanding of life in general, not just about people, I guess. It's about, yeah, everything in life. But, yeah, I know from my classmates that when we completed it, that it had changed everyone's thoughts massively.
Yeah, Long Tran, I'm thinking that this belongs in workplaces as well. Schools, workplaces, the whole gamut.
I totally agree with you, yeah. I mean, it should be educated. A lot of people should learn about how to, you know, how to talk to people with disability, how to communicate with them. I reckon it's all about that, yeah.
Jaben Saunders, how has this participating in this program affected you?
Firstly, it's given me happiness in the fact that I have a meaningful job. This is the first meaningful job I've ever worked in, and that is so great because employment is one of the hardest aspects for people with disabilities, and yeah, so it's helped me immensely in that field, and it's also given me a lot of confidence working with colleagues that know and acknowledge my disability, and it's made me a lot happier that I am integrating with students and making myself aware of people like Ron. When I met him, I wouldn't say he had a disability until he disclosed it. It takes a lot of courage to disclose you have a disability.
It sure does. And Long, thank you for talking about that experience on the program this morning.
That's all right. Thank you for having me.
Look, terrific to hear about this program. I reckon it's a winner all round by the sounds of all your experiences. Jaben Saunders, Long Tran and Kirsty Lamb, thank you very much for joining us on Life Matters this morning.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you, Natasha.
How's that, hey? Goodness. Wow. That is the Scope Young Ambassador Program, and joining me was Kirsty Lamb, Long Tran, and Jaben Saunders, an educator with the program. And you can get in touch with Scope about getting a program up and running in your school if you're interested. There's also education programs for adults, I gather, and you'll find more info on the Life Matters website. Just head to this particular story and you'll find a link there. Interested if you've had an experience of copping flak at school, particularly because of a disability. What were the consequences? What have been the consequences in your life, do you think, of that experience? Get in touch with us. Well, now to our Monday Modern Dilemma, our weekly series. Today's is for anyone who's pursued a personal goal so relentlessly, regardless of the personal and financial risks. I mean, and doing that can bring a great sense of pleasure to our lives. But Rachel wrote to us with this. I have been with my partner for 16 years. We've four children in their teenage years. We've never been very good at managing our money and have never earned much. About 5 years ago, my partner decided to open his own business and I supported him in this. The business that my partner started has never really gotten off the ground. He took out a loan to get it started that he finds difficult to pay and he struggles to keep up with his bills. The only input to the house finances he can make is to pay our monthly rent for our house, and often this is late or most recently he couldn't pay it. The money I earn goes towards groceries, bills and any other school or living cost for our family. I work for 3 days a week and bring home more money than my partner, who it seems is working most of the time. I now long for him to stop the business and get a job that pays sufficiently for us to live without constant financial pressure. My attitude has now become one of intolerance, and that hurts him a lot, and I kind of wish I wasn't so intolerant of his choice in wanting to keep trying to make the business work. He thinks I just want him to earn lots of money, which is not the case. I have no particular wish to be well off, but I do have a desire to live with less stress if we can. Am I right in feeling negative about his business decision? Oh, I think this is one that many will relate to. And joining us, I'm delighted to say, is social commentator and writer Nina Fennell. Welcome back, Nina.
Good morning.
And also Jonathan Nicholas, your partner in crime often in this segment. Jonathan is, of course, CEO of the Inspire Foundation. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan, how far can love take us in supporting our partner's dreams, no matter how unsustainable they are?
Look, I think love can take you a long way, but often a great relationship is who are you willing to compromise for and how much are you willing to compromise? And often relationships break down not because we don't love the other person, but because we are unwilling to compromise our individual needs for a joint need. And I think that's really the central issue here is it's not their business, it's his business. She's supporting him, not necessarily involved. And so I think really that the challenge for her is that she feels on the outer of it, and commentating in rather than it being a partnership where they're in this together and making decisions together, and that's always going to lead to some pretty significant trouble.
Yes, it's whether they've got the time to actually make it a joint activity, I guess.
Absolutely.
That's a challenge. Nina, I want to make this point, that the support of a partner can allow us to take risks that we might not take alone, you know, and we often, you know, we only have one life, so why not take that sometimes the more financially risky but ultimately perhaps more satisfying path.
Yes, and I think that risk was taken in this particular case, but it was taken 5 years ago and the risk has not paid off. It's 5 years down the track and they're still obviously struggling. And I think that the reason why Rachel is writing in is because there's a certain level of resentment that has built up, because over those 5 years she's obviously made a lot of sacrifices, and not just financial sacrifices, but sacrifices around the quality time that they spend together. You know, she says that he's constantly stressed, he brings work home, it's actually impacting on their ability to function as a couple. Mm. And I think that from her perspective, she refers to it as being intolerant. I actually think that she's actually becoming quite frustrated. Also, you know, adding to that, she's actually bringing home the lion's share of the wealth as well. And my other question that I wanted to, you know, if we had her in, I'd also ask her about how their work-life balance at home is going on in terms of the housework, because if he's constantly busy doing the other work and, you know, they've got four teenage kids, somebody's got to
get them working.
Yeah.
I think we talked about that recently on the show, didn't we? Robin writes on our Facebook page, it's a tough one, isn't it? You don't mention whether or not he loves what he does, but if he does and he's forced to chuck it in, I don't imagine he'll be a happy little Vegemite. I understand your point of view, she says to writer Rachel, but for me, my business nourishes my soul and reflects everything I firmly believe in, and there's no right or wrong way for you to feel. It is what it is. Good luck. So there you go. I mean, pursuing someone's passions is certainly something a partner like Rachel can help with, but there's a limit. How much, Jonathan, can financial strain, how much trouble can it cause a relationship?
It's often one of the key reasons why relationships break down, not only because of general life strain, how can we live day to day, how can we do the things that we want and all that goes along with that, but often how we earn money and how we spend money is actually an expression of our values. And relationships quite often break down because of a difference in values. And I think that's really what's also underlying here is they're actually having values conversations through money. I don't want you to be
rich, I just want to earn enough, but you really want me to be rich and you just want me to do certain things. Now, they're not really money things. They're really values problems. And that is probably, I think, the key thing here, where you probably need someone else in the middle of that conversation to take some of the emotion out of it so you can get to a core issue and have a joint plan together. And that's often what a psychologist or a relationship counsellor will help with.
Yes, and therein lies a challenge perhaps for Rachel's partner, that he would be both not just financially invested in this, but incredibly emotionally invested. And if I'm thinking about, well, all of us in work, but men in work particularly, there might be a degree of shame. If the business is failing, then somehow it's a sense of failure for him too as a person.
Absolutely. And I think it's probably important we're hearing her side of the story, but what is he actually hearing which she may not be saying? And I suspect that if she's saying, I want you to change the job or close it down, he may actually be hearing, you think I'm a failure as a person, not you think the business is failing. And again, that will likely make anyone defensive. And he probably is hearing that in different ways from different people. If the business isn't a success, then that's a real kind of struggle. And I think the challenge for her is to give him a way out that's a way out together, not a way out for him independently. And that's, again, part of the challenge for her, is that resentfulness is really creating a level of separation between the two. And it's, how do you come together to have a joint solution where he feels part of it and he feels like she's still supporting him as a person, even if she's commenting or criticising the success of the business?
Nina Fennell, how would you see them coming together on this one?
Oh, that's a toughie. I think Jonathan's right in that she has to actually give him a way out where he can save face, because I think that a lot of this is about, I don't want to say particularly for men, but in this case, I think that there is that question about, is he going to lose face by admitting that this has failed? I mean, one way in which she could manage that is, I think she needs to have a discussion with him where she talks about what is working and what's not working in their relationship. And really, you know, beneath every argument over who's bringing home the bacon and so on, there are questions about respect and appreciation. And I think that she's not feeling particularly appreciated in this, because she's not getting quality time with him. And if she talks to him about that and talks to him about her needs regarding that, and finds some sort of balance where he can continue to pursue his passions while simultaneously being there for her and for them as a couple, I think that's one way in which they could move forward.
Jonathan, what could relationships counselling perhaps do for this? I mean, sometimes it's the challenge is getting a couple to that stage and both of them agreeing that this might be something useful. It's not signalling the end of their relationship, it's actually a potential new beginning.
Absolutely. I think, I mean, the first thing is a recognition that there is actually a relationship issue, and by saying we need to go and speak to someone third party, whether it be a relationship counsellor, it's actually that process of admitting is really, really important. Also, the other part is that in the context of this, they're using, or she's using, quite emotive language. And when we use emotive language to describe something factual, I'm resentful that the business isn't doing so well, then people hear different things. And often having a psychologist or a counsellor in the middle of that can help you take out the emotive language, get to the core of the issue, and most importantly, come up with a plan to do something together. Now, that may mean I'll back you in your business because I now understand this is really important to you in your independent identity, or we actually just have to do something different because this business is hurting our family and we've decided together that our family is more important than pursuing the business. Whatever way it works, it's really about getting to the core of those sorts of issues.
And a financial counsellor might also play a sort of another role here too, talking about the nuts and bolts and mechanics of the finances, even if her partner says, well, money's not a focus here. Well, clearly money is an issue here for them because they're scraping the barrel at times, aren't they? Nina?
Well, obviously, I think money's an issue. I mean, money's an issue for everybody, let's be honest about this.
Damn it.
and perhaps a financial counsellor could work as well, because she starts her letter off by saying that they've never been particularly good at managing their income or managing their finances. So maybe it's about, you know, upskilling themselves.
Some literacy.
And developing a budget and working out how their goals and their ambitions and their passions in terms of, you know, the business and or and pursuing that can fit within a budget and whether or not that is in fact feasible. And perhaps that's where the conversation could actually begin.
I thought we got an interesting one from on Facebook from Susie, a listener Susie. Most men are very sensitive when it comes to work-related issues. Don't forget, practical things aside, you are dealing with deep emotion here, feeling like a failure being the biggest. He needs gentle support and encouragement, perhaps that it's okay to let go of the business and try something new. Although it's hard to support your partner when you feel angry and let down by them. So she sort of encapsulates what you're saying. But she also says this, setting some time limits could help. That is, if in 3 months the business has not brought in X amount, he will look for work or part-time work. Or the kids get some work she names a fast food chain, or do the housework so mum can work more elsewhere. So there's a practical solution, giving a time frame rather than, as she says, Susie says, don't just let it go on and on with no direction or no end in sight. You know, that might be a way of doing it.
Absolutely. And I think the most important thing to ask is, what are we afraid of? Often what we're afraid of is a much more powerful driver of our behaviour than what we want. If he's afraid of the business collapsing, that actually may make him more likely to work harder, work longer, even if that all the evidence is telling you the reverse. There may be also a very good thing is, if he's been pursuing this for 5 years and been out of the workforce and he says, if I don't do this, what else can I do? Mm. And often the fear of changing career for anyone is a very powerful reason to stay where you are. So again, part of this is both for him and for her to understand, what are we afraid of, what do we want, and how do we come together around that? And that will open up some of the practical solutions that the listeners are coming up with, that really is really about coming to a joint plan that allows them both to invest, rather than her be on the outside of the decisions and him feeling probably like he's being battered from all angles.
Yeah. Nina Fennell, feelings of resentment are never a good starting place, are they? But they often are the starting place for these conversations.
And I actually very much agree with what Jonathan's saying of identifying what it is that you're afraid of, but also defining what we mean by failure, because ending a business that is not successful is not necessarily a sign of failure. It's actually a smart business decision to make. And if you're doing something that's in the best interest of your family long term or the best interest of your relationship, that's not a failure either. That's actually a success. So I think having a discussion about, not just only what it is that we're afraid of, but how do we define terms like failure could actually be an important constructive conversation for them to have.
Absolutely. Any final comments for Rachel as she tries to navigate this tetchy conversation with her partner, so much invested in this?
I think the biggest danger for her is that she gives up. At least with resentfulness and anger, you're emotionally engaged. I think at the point where you say, I'm emotionally disengaged,
and I'm walking,
and I'm then you're emotionally walking, even if you haven't physically got there yet. And so I think the great thing out of this is that she's upset and she's angry, and she needs to have embraced that and have that conversation with him. I suspect he's also upset and angry, and she knows that in another way.
That's a very interesting take on a kind of affirmation of the role of anger to motivate change in relationships.
Absolutely. Anger is a very, very powerful emotion for change, and the thing is to acknowledge it and turn it into a constructive behaviour, which is we need to get to a better solution. And often where anger builds up and turns into resentfulness and then turns into not caring is where we don't acknowledge it and also don't give it an outlet that is positive. So I think that's really for her probably the starting point here, and then really for him is to hopefully hear what she's saying and then come out of it together.
I find that very optimistic. Yeah, that's a very optimistic end to the conversation. Rachel, I hope you got something out of that as you listen. And, of course, all our Modern Dilemmas discussions are on our website and on a special page, so you can go there and download the lot if you want a feast of ethical conundrums. Can I thank you both for joining us again on the program and thinking this through so carefully for our listeners?
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Social commentator and writer Nina Fennell, along with the CEO of the Inspire Foundation, Jonathan Nicholas. Life Matters back on your airwaves with me, Natasha Mitchell, tomorrow. Thanks to the Cracker Life Matters team and to executive producer Julie Browning, sound engineer Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, and thanks to you. News is next on RN.